Hi, I'm Yaakov Katz, and welcome to the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of the State of Affairs in Israel and the Jewish World. On today's episode, we're going to take a look at the situation between Israel and the diaspora. How bad is it? And what can be done to repair the rift, which has grown since the ongoing war in the Gaza Strip? To do that, I spoke with Yisrael Klitzner, the former diaspora affairs advisor to then Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. Yisrael also has an interesting story from October 7th. He was living in Pittsburgh, where his wife was doing a fellowship as a doctor at a nearby hospital, and he was studying for a master's degree at Carnegie Mellon. He returned to Israel, rejoined his commando unit in the IDF as a miluimnik, a reservist, and then continued to fight in the West Bank and a couple of months also in Khan Yunis. We speak at length about what it was like inside Gaza, the transition from going from Pittsburgh back to Israel into a war, and what's next for the Israel-diaspora relationship. I then catch up with two of my JPPI colleagues, Professor Gil Troy, who's joining us from the United States. We'll talk with him also about this Israel-diaspora divide. And of course, with Shmuel Rosner, our jack of all trades, to look at this hot issue. But first, we're going to hear from Yisrael Klitzner, the former diaspora affairs advisor to Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. Here we go. Yisrael Klitzner, it's great to have you on the JPPI podcast.
Good to be here, Yaakov.
So before we dive in to what we're here to talk about with you, which is Israel diaspora relations, some of the U.S.-Israel situation that gets more tense as the days go by, take us back for a moment to October 7th. You are in Pittsburgh, right? And October 7th, Pittsburgh, is that snow in Pittsburgh then?
Close, icy.
Yeah. It's icy already. and you're there. Your wife is doing a fellowship as a doctor in a hospital. You had you were doing a master's degree at a local university and
public policy in Carnegie Mellon. Yep.
Okay, and then October 7th happens.
Correct. Yeah.
So what happens to the Klitzner family?
I'll rewind, if it's okay with you, Yaakov, a little bit further than that, which is I was working for the Naftali Bennett government as the diaspora affairs advisor, as you mentioned, and the government collapsed soon after that. I think it was no more than 3 weeks after the collapse. My wife and I and our four children were already on a plane on the way to Pittsburgh, as she was going to take the reins and pursue her dream to become a specialized physician in ophthalmology. So we went to Pittsburgh and spent the year and a half there that was cut short. We were supposed to be there for two and a half, or even 3 years. October 7th, as you mentioned, came along and caught everybody by surprise. I remembered like it was yesterday. I was going to go on a walk with two of my friends from the Jewish Federation and from the JCC. We were going to just take our morning Shabbat walk. And they saw the news before I did, because I don't tend to look at my phone on Shabbat. Immediately I understood the gravity of it and went inside and looked at my wife, Lori, and she saw the look in my eyes, and after a brief conversation, it became clear that I needed to go back and fight alongside my the unit that I served with and my guys. I served in a unit called Duv Devan. Right. So rejoined my team. My wife stayed back in Pittsburgh for the first 6 weeks of the war. I was in Israel, initially stationed in the West Bank, and after 6 weeks, we were told that we were going to be moved into Khan Yunis in Gaza. And then at that point, I said to my wife, and she was on the same page, that we're probably best being in the same continent and in the same country. So she came here with the four kids, no less heroic in her journey, and made that trip alone. But about 2 months ago, I got out. And probably going to end up back in Miluim sometime soon. Yeah.
So you were how long in Gaza?
In Gaza itself for about 2 months. Before that, prior to that, I spent about 2 months, a little less than 2 months in the West Bank as well.
Now, the IDF on Sunday pulled out of most of its forces out of Gaza, pulled out of Khan Yunis, which is where you had operated, basically saying that we're moving from a, you know, a war situation more to a combat situation, keeping some forces from the 162nd Division up in the north to continue to keep the north of Gaza cut off from the rest of Gaza, but saying that they're going to keep going back in as required and basically regrouping ahead of a possible offensive on the ground in Rafiah, what is more known as Rafah. But, you know, as we mark this moment, which also comes, you know, came on the day that Israel marked 6 months to the war, someone who had spent 2 months in Khan Yunis, I mean, maybe just walk us through for a moment. What was there? What was that like?
Mostly just fear of the unknown. Any given day, any given moment, we were all surrounded by threats that came from every which direction. So our mornings usually began by being targeted by mortar shells. And then in the afternoon, we usually had some intelligence telling us that there is a sniper in the area. There were a few times where that materialized, and the imminent threat of being targeted accidentally by many of the forces that were in our immediate vicinity.
Friendly fire.
So friendly fire always very much on our minds. Again, there too, unfortunately, that threat materialized, thank goodness, in a way that didn't bring any harm to anyone, but certainly the threat was there and constant. And then beyond that, terrorists springing out of, just as we recently unfortunately lost four soldiers to such an instance where terrorists came out of these small tunnels, these shafts, and killed soldiers and went right back into that hole that they came out of, impossible to find and impossible to detect ahead of time, and making the warfare, like I said, very anxiety-filled and not really knowing. You know, usually when I was in my mandatory service in Duvdevan, we knew exactly what our enemy looked like and what we were going after. In this case, we knew the enemy was there. We just rarely ever saw the enemy. And I think from much of my conversations with my fellow service people, I've heard the same things over and over again, which is, yeah, we barely see any enemies, but we're being targeted by them. It's not that they're not there.
You know, I think it's an important issue because 6 months since this war, a lot of people, I still feel, don't fully comprehend or grasp the complex of and the complicated terrain and the battlefield in Gaza because of the mix between the civilian infrastructure, the way it's used by the terrorists, the way, like you said, they're jumping out of these shafts, popping right back in, firing off an anti-tank missile or shooting at, you know, ambushing a small little group or contingent of IDF soldiers. The, you know, I think you had told me that, and you guys, it's important also to note that Israeli soldiers, when they're in Gaza, I mean, where are they sleeping? They're going into homes, right? Or they're, you know, they're going into apartments and fortifying themselves, obviously, but you're spending time inside these buildings and you're discovering a lot of the way they live. And, you know, maybe tell us a bit about that, like, you know, the tunnels that are there, the paraphernalia that's there. Like, what did you see?
Sure. We slept for a few weeks, consecutive weeks, in a relatively small but nice home, something that I think would be considered a 3-4 million shekel apartment in Israel easily. And it was, of course, bombarded, so half ruined, but the parts that were intact, you see a lot of the way that they're living and the ways that they're living, and it seemed, at least from a naked eye, an observer, to be quite dignified and a nice living standard. for us, again, we this was only a means to an end. The three out of four walls that were standing were supposed to provide us some shelter, or at least let us feel like we had shelter. And it didn't really provide that, because at the end of the day, when we knew that mortar shells were landing near us, these walls are not going to provide much of a barrier between us and the mortar. But we also found plenty of shafts right next to us. There was one night, I remember this, where we were standing guard, a friend of mine and I, and everything. All these threats that I just mentioned, they all converged in the same exact hour. I would say the same exact minute, where on the one hand, we were looking straight out at a few shafts that were no more than 50 yards away from us, with night vision, trying to see, make sure that nobody's coming out of them and posing an imminent threat to us. And at the same exact time, we heard on the radio that we were being locked on by an anti-tank missile, and at the same time, there was also intelligence of someone who was sniping nearby, which we thought could very easily end up in our range as well. So, you know, all these things flying around in your mind at the same exact time, needless to say, that was a sleepless night, but one of many of those types of sleepless sure. nights that leave you feeling like, and I think here I'll zoom out to the macro a little bit from the micro picture of what fighting looks like inside these homes, in the macro of where are we heading with this war, and how do you actually reach what everybody is calling the victory that we so desperately need against?
So how do you reach that victory, Israel?
I think that words are easy to say, and they were pretty easy for Prime Minister Netanyahu to say at the beginning of this war. I am putting these two major goals and setting them forth, and they are unbreakable goals. And one is to defeat Hamas's military capabilities, and the other is to ensure that the hostages return home. But obviously, when it comes to defeating Hamas's military capabilities, there is a reason the IDF in consecutive rounds against Hamas did not go in full force. And the estimates would always vary. Is it going to be 500? Is it going to be 1,000 soldiers who are going to die? And even when we pay that heavy price that we cannot fathom, because everybody here is so intertwined and every family knows of the other family, even at that point, it's still not clear that ensuring that these Hamas operatives are not going to be able to carry out the types of attacks that they were able to carry out the day before we entered into this territory, it's just not a given. And we've seen the military build up time and again, get to the point where they're amassing not only the weapons externally by way of the border between Rafah and Egypt, but also through their own internal capabilities and these makeshift bomb factories that are right. in people's homes and in tunnels. And I fear that we're going to continue seeing that. You know, there's the famous saying, "Lenetzach nichye or namut al charbeinu." We're going to have to live on and die on our sword, because we're living with the enemy right on our border that wants nothing more than to commit genocide on our people and nothing less. So we need to be ready.
We need to fight. You know, yep. I want to jump from that point to your last job as the advisor to the Prime Minister for Diaspora Affairs. And, you know, you were in Gaza, you're fighting in Gaza, and clearly we've lost international support, right? Yep. You know, if we thought we still had some, comes the world, you know, central kitchen incident tragedy. Yeah, and that kind of blowing up those cars, we also blew up any last legitimacy that we might have had around the world or support And, you know, there's still some pockets of legitimacy and there's still some pockets of support. But I think largely we have everybody now calling for a ceasefire. Everybody wants this war over. The Americans don't see eye to eye with us on the way we think we should prosecute an operation in Rafah. They want to see it done differently. But you know, part of this support also has to do with the Jewish community. And it has to do with the, particularly the American Jewish community. You also used to work for AIPAC back in the day. And I'm curious, and from your perspective, what could we, are we doing enough to engage with American or general diaspora Jewish communities? And if not, because I assume your answer might be no, what more could we be doing?
So one of the things that I did, it was about a week after I finished my service in Gaza, is I went to the States. I was asked by a few Jewish communities there to come and speak. And I went on this speaking tour for about two and a half weeks. And I got to feel the pain that is not only happening here in Israel, but also that, that is being experienced over in the United States. And one of the things that I'll begin with the positive that brought me great solace and made me feel what I've always felt, which is part of a greater tribe, a Jewish tribe that spans the geographic boundaries of Israel or the United States, but really anywhere in the world. And that is that everywhere I went, people were really looking to feel, to emote, to feel like they are a part of the same effort that is being waged against Hamas in what is in an existential battle for the Israeli people. And feeling like they're, you know, even though they are saying these things from afar, that they truly feel like they are one and the same and they're in this together with us. And that brought me great comfort. To your question of, are we doing enough? I fear that our government has not been doing us much favors by way of making this relationship easier or, I would say, smoother along these lines. When I left Pittsburgh on October 10th or 11th, I'm trying to remember the exact date, I spoke in the Jewish community there at the JCC together with they held an event together with the Federation. And one of the things that I said is, remember this moment, remember this feeling, this visceral feeling that everybody's feeling right now of what just took place in Israel and how horrible that massacre was. Because as time goes by, we're gonna lose touch with that visceral sense that we're feeling right now. And it's going to be harder to relate to what Israel is doing and why it's doing it. And the more the casualties amount on the Palestinian side, as tragic as that will be, and it will be tragic, we need to remain focused on why, again, why it is that Israel is in this place to begin with and why it needs to continue to do what it is indeed doing. Having said all of that, and having already voiced that I do feel great pain and concern for the many, many Palestinian lives that have been lost inside Gaza, as well as non-Palestinians, as you mentioned, the tragedy that just took place with the World Food Bank. I think that that when I said that the government is not doing us any favors in aiding along this, to begin with, difficult relationship or ailing relationship, when there's low-hanging fruit, when the government can go so far as say, we're going to take certain measures to ensure humanitarian aid, or at the very least tell the Americans, we know this is a great concern of yours. Here, you tell us your plan. Let's see how we can secure that plan in ways that allow us and our military to maneuver the way it needs to, and ensure that there are no objects or items that are making its way into their way into Gaza that are going to potentially provide a threat to the people of Israel. But I fear that those lines of communication have been fraught with internal Israeli politics far too many times. Mm-hmm. certainly coming out of Netanyahu's mouth, but also coming out of some of the other spokespeople around him, including Minister Dermer and others that are supposed to be stewarding this relationship. That again, I think it's almost silly to reverberate why this is so important, but it should be clear to all that this relationship is paramount to the existence and the continued flourishing of the state of Israel. And of course, it's a two-way street and should be helpful to the United States as well. But it's not going to be helpful to either side so long as internal political rhetoric keeps getting in the way. And we keep going down these rabbit holes that are putting I would say, good-hearted and very willing pro-Israel individuals in the United States that also happen to be Democratic-leaning individuals in a difficult spot, in a place where they have to decide who to believe. Do they believe their own government? Do they believe President Biden or Chuck Schumer, when Chuck Schumer has been a longstanding ally with Israel, and suddenly he gives this speech that really parts ways with the way that he was thinking and acting for many years, or do they believe the Israeli government that is saying, oh yeah, it's all the Americans' fault. We're doing what we need to do. And that's not a good place to put the American Jewish community in.
But I mean, you know, I've heard from American Jews, you know, yeah, like in the past, and maybe a little less in this war. But, you know, when you in Israel set policy, you're not considering what happens here, right? In other words, in the U.S., you're not considering what this does to anti-Semitism. You're not considering what it does to kids on college campuses. Now, I don't think you can expect that of a country, right? Israel has to worry first and foremost about its 9-10 million people and their safety and security, but it should be something of a consideration, no?
Absolutely. There's no question. But I'll give an example of what I'm trying to get at here. When I was with the prime minister, so he had sent a small delegation prior to his visit in Washington to meet with Biden for the first time. And I was there together with Shimrit Meir and with Eyal Chulata and one other person. And we went for a few meetings. And at a certain point, we were given the floor to speak, and Shimrit and Eyal gave the Israeli talking points, and the Americans gave their talking points. But it was clear to me that the conversation was moving not towards each other, but I would say in parallel to one another. And one of the things that I had mentioned afterwards and suggested as potentially something we can think about is, you know, the Americans at that time, not right now, but I would say maybe still, the thing that was on their mind most was China. And part of the Chinese threat that they were trying to consider was where does Israel fall within the Chinese question? So I said, why don't we start off with China? Think about some, again, low-hanging fruit that we can say, here's what we've already done by way of these troubled relations that you have with China that we know we're getting in the middle of, so here's what we're going to do. And it's easy, right? Most of these things are not, you don't have to actually step out of your way in order to, or completely shift your foreign policy in order to get to that point. But you can actually say, we understand, because what you're really saying to the Americans is, we get you. We understand the language that you are speaking. We understand the concerns that you have. We understand the rationality through which you are working, and we not only understand it, we are willing to move in your direction to make sure that those concerns are tended to. That's not to say, and this is an important point, it's not to say that Israelis can't have their own concerns, because we can, and that's not to say that we don't have our prerogative that we should act on first and foremost in anything related to our own security needs and what those immediate needs are, and we should tackle them the way we see fit. But that is to say, again, that when we have this type of relationship, when the United States is providing diplomatic blanket immunity for Israel at the UN, when the United States is providing a memorandum of understanding prior to this war of $3.8 billion per year over a 10-year period, when there is, whenever Israel is in a bind with munitions, there is a refill well on its way. There needs to be a deeper consideration. There needs to be a deeper understanding of what this relationship stands for and how vital and important it is when moving these relations forward. And that's not only on the geostrategic side, it's also on the level of our Jewish brothers and sisters that are living across the border and how we can better help them be part of this picture and feel the same things that we are feeling, as opposed to feeling like they are conflicted between two realities, one United States and one in Israel.
This is complicated stuff, Yisrael, but no simple answers in these issues, but I definitely want to thank you for being with us. I want to thank you for your service with, coming back and really just another story, ladies and gentlemen, of the dedication of Israelis, reservists who, without thinking, get on a plane, come back to Israel and go fight, and then flip over their lives once again. So thank you for that. And thank you for your insight. It was great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Yaakov. Really good to be here.
So that was Yisrael Klitzner, who served during the Naftali Bennett premiership as his diaspora affairs advisor. And I think just also in general, just a very moving story of which we've heard so many over the last 6 months, not years yet, of how so many of these people dropped everything they were doing and came back to Israel. And really still, even 6 months later, I have to say personally, some of these stories are still very, very moving. Even now, as we're kind of, unclear where we're headed. But I want to talk, Gil, I know we're catching you in New York City. Your red eye landed from the West Coast. And now you're getting ready for the eclipse. Okay.
Just to lighten the mood.
Exactly. Why not? Maybe you should put them on. But, I spoke with Yisrael just a bit about also.
Many of our leaders have them on because they blind you.
I spoke with Yisrael about this, the Israel diaspora divide a bit. There's no question, I think, that today in the aftermath of, 6 months of this war, the WCK tragedy, the whole world calling for a ceasefire, the devastation in Gaza, we're not with a great deal of international support. That might be an understatement, but we're also facing a lot of our own people who are slightly turning away and wondering what Israel's doing and where Israel's going. You're there on the ground right now in the U.S. What's your take?
It's sobering. Everybody wants, and we've said this before, a 67 victory and an Entebbe victory. The horrors of the October 7th massacre still echo. And in many ways, in some of the synagogues I spoke at, in some of the Jewish communities I spoke at, the trauma lingers in a way that it doesn't really linger in Israel anymore, because we've moved on, because we had so many other things going on. And so on the one hand, I echo the notion of just the tremendous empathy and the tremendous connectedness. But there is also a kind of frustration, a fear about the growing rift with the United States of America, the growing criticism. But more and more American Jews, and let's emphasize, very few American Jews have experienced what Israel has experienced. Very few American Jews know what it is to walk into a war zone. They don't know what it is to have the fog of war. They don't know what it is to be a drone operator and press a button because you think there must be a Hamasnik hiding behind yet another civilian convoy, and boom, then you've made this mistake, which becomes a diplomatic catastrophe. So I think while there's been tremendous empathy for Israel about October 7th and what we endured when we were bleeding, I think we do need a lot more empathy also about what we endure and what our holy soldiers endure when they're fighting. And the other thing I want to say is that we sometimes make instant assessments of what's happening in the war right now, 6 month mark. And the war is kind of continuing. Blackened reputations can be rehabilitated. I don't think we should fall for the Palestinian propaganda line that they're winning, because it's true we've absorbed some very, very severe blows from October 7th and, you know, the distancing at this moment from the United States. But I think we also have to emphasize that most Palestinians, even though they don't say it, understand that they have paid a very, very heavy price for Hamas's evil, for Hamas's arrogance, and the destruction that's been wrought in Gaza, as heartbreaking as it is also a message to Hezbollah, to Iran, to the Houthis, to Palestinians elsewhere, that there are consequences for these kind of actions. And so we shouldn't negate many of the war aims that have occurred on the ground.
So, Shmuel, I want to take this in maybe a slightly different direction, but also connected to everything we were just talking about. And that was yesterday's news of the IDF pulling out of Khan Yunis. We've left, contrary to the headlines around the world, Israel has withdrawn from Gaza. We still have the Nahal Brigade in the north of Gaza. We still have boots on the ground. There were missile strikes today in Khan Yunis. So Israel has not left the Gaza Strip just yet. But there is definitely a transition from what I call the HIC, the high-intensity conflict, to the LIC, the low-intensity conflict, in terms of warfare that people might be familiar with. But the question is why, right? And I think that if I want to be not a conspiracy theorist, but more like thinking a few steps ahead here, what people might not realize in the U.S. and around the world right now is that come Friday, that's going to be the last day of school for about 2 million school children who then go on Pesach, Passover holiday break on Sunday, and they're off for about 2.5 weeks almost. And then after Passover, we immediately are going to go into a period of mourning that starts with Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, a few days later, Yom HaZikaron, the IDF Remembrance Day, and then, of course, you know, culminating in the Independence Day and Yom HaTzmaut. And I'm thinking that if what Netanyahu might be wanting here is for to see if he can obviously get a hostage deal, and we're hearing conflicting reports what's coming out. But does he want us sitting around the Seder table? And we know that, you know, 90-something% of Israelis sit at the Seder table, and probably, you know, many Jews do around the world. Does he want us talking about the failures of October 7th, or does he want us talking about maybe how he became the modern day Moses and took out the slaves / hostages from the Gaza Strip, if that's possible? And by pulling out so many soldiers, what he's basically indicating to Hamas is, hey, I've met your guys' demands, pretty much, right? I've left some troops, but I pulled out most of the troops. Now we got to work on the details, and we got to finalize this deal, and we got now 2 weeks to make it happen. How crazy is what I just said?
Well, it's not crazy, but it's probably just a part of the story. I think the what we see today is the result of many different dynamics that led Israel to the current situation. International pressure is certainly one of them. Israel had to contend with a growing pressure from different countries, especially the U.S., but not just the U.S., and had to respond to this pressure in at least some way. And I think pulling out is one way for Israel to say, okay, we are letting Gazans to begin going back on their daily lives or their daily routines and go back to their homes if they still have homes, etc. It allows for Israel and for international organizations to hand more humanitarian aid to Gazans. If the IDF is not there, you don't have soldiers putting themselves in harm's way in order to provide food for Gazans, food and waters and shelter and all the other things. It's also possible that the IDF no longer has clear targets in the areas in which its troops spend the last 5 months.
Right.
If the IDF goes into the area of Rafah, then they will have a new list of targets that they have to deal with. But up until then, the list is empty. The IDF can go back and forth and deal with developing problems as they occur, but you don't have to keep all these forces inside Israel. And what you said about the hostage deal, that's the next component of, or one of the important components. Clearly, we are yet again, and we must say this because we've been at this point at least five times when people were saying, well, the hostage deal is just around the corner. And then we had to wake up and realize that it's not happening this time. So we might be again at this crossroads in which Israel will have to decide whether it wants a hostage deal, what is the price that Israel is willing to pay, which puts the prime minister and the government under pressure, both from international players, from the public, and from members of the coalition. So there are at least three pressure points on the government, one from the international community. They certainly want a deal and they would like Israel to accept whatever terms it is offered. You have the pressure from the part of the public that is highly supportive of a deal, that wants the government to take the deal now and whatever the terms might be. But you also have part of the public and some of the members of the coalition who will not take it lightly if Israel agrees now to the terms that it refused to accept a month or 2 months ago. First, because then you'll have to ask yourself, well, if we could have had this deal 2 months ago, why didn't we go for it? Right. And second, because some Israelis think that this deal is unworthy. It's not the deal that Israel ought to take. They would like the war to intensify and not to become less intense.
You know, but do agree with me for a moment that if you are Netanyahu or if you're his speechwriter, there's nothing. I mean, you know, the psukim of the verses are from the Exodus or just from the Haggadah, you know, of Lakachti, Heveti, Gaalti, right? All those, you know, I brought, I took out, I liberated. They just write the speech that he could potentially give on the eve of Passover if there is to be, please God, at least I pray for there to be a hostage deal. But Gil, I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, you know, with the what appears to be this wind down of the war right now, and we definitely are seeing much more talk about humanitarian aid. Netanyahu, of course, announcing last week that Israel's going to start letting in aid also through the Ashdod port. There were pictures that came out yesterday of Defense Minister Gallant touring a new aid coordination center together with the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Jack Lew. So we as a country are putting much more of an emphasis on this, and the war is winding down. Is that going to balance out to some extent the frustration, anger, hostility that there is right now in the U.S. with Israel?
Yaakov, you have a character flaw. You focus on the truth.
Only one?
You focus, you're talking about things that there, people are seeing in Israel, because we're actually looking at things that are on the ground. One of the problems that I'm sensing in my conversations with so many of my American brothers and sisters is that they're getting a very simplistic, very biased, very distorted view on CNN and on social media. And I think almost every single thing, as you were talking, I'm going, huh, I haven't read that in the New York Times. Huh, I haven't read that in the New York Times. Huh, it doesn't exist in the American Jewish conversation, let alone the American conversation. And what most terrifies me, I don't even think it's existing on the American policy level. So one of the things we have to do is, first of all, just wait and see, because I think we have a healthy appreciation of our own powerlessness when it comes to changing the media narrative. But absolutely, one should start calling on the media obsessives who have been pounding away, who've made this war a war between Israel and the Gazan innocents rather than Israel and Hamas, who have put the hostages to a certain aside, who've put all the moral dilemmas that we hear from so many soldiers aside. And we have to start demanding that reporters report about what's happening. Don't give me a spin. Don't give me a propaganda victory. Just give me that kind of nuance that you just gave in 22 seconds that is missing from most conversations about the war right now. So it's really three possibilities. Possibility number one, this media mania continues, and then no matter what we do, the pile on against Israel continues. Number two, is that they start reporting it in a more nuanced way. Or number three is that Israel just falls off the media mattering map and they move on to Biden, Trump, or some other issue. And I'm not wise enough to predict or bold enough to predict what's going to happen, but those tend to be the patterns of what happens. You know, when if you go back over 20 years, when Israel went in during in April 2002, after the Passover massacre, and 130 Israelis were killed, which at the time was a mind-blowing number. And for a couple of weeks, everybody's talking about Jenin and the Israelis. And then Israel's operations wound down. They continued to go in nightly, but it wasn't reported, so it didn't happen. So we didn't pay the reputational cost, and we were actually able to control the situation. So there's this media X factor that I wish was based on truth. I wish was based with Yaakov Katz as the editor-in-chief of all time. But unfortunately, we're living in a world where it's just a matter of, is it going to get clickbait? And is this narrative going to continue? And is the insane way the Palestinian protesters and the progressives have been able to run this conversation going to continue?
Well, I mean, you know, so maybe here's where we say thank God for Donald Trump, because if there's anyone who can change the media narrative, it's that man. Shmuel, I'm curious also just about Netanyahu's political calculation, right? The war, everyone had thought that he was going to keep the war going at this high intensity stage because it would serve him. As long as there's a war, no one's going to resign, no one in the IDF. And the moment people in the IDF resign, that starts to put the spotlight on the political echelon. There's not going to yet be the questions, there aren't yet going to be the protests, although now we are seeing some protests, but those still very focused regarding the hostages. Now that things are winding down, or appear to be at least, and even if Rafah is going to happen, what I think we need to remember is that in the best case scenario, which is the Israeli scenario, it takes 4 weeks to move the mass amount of people out of harm's way in Rafah. According to the U.S. estimate, we're talking about 4 months, if not more. So I say let's go somewhere in the middle. We're looking at about 2 months. This is a long time before you even get to see the cannons blazing and the tanks, you know, plowing through the southern Gaza city of Rafah. So there's time till that happens. And therefore, there's now this window of, I would call it maybe vulnerability politically for Netanyahu. No?
Netanyahu is under immense political pressure. We see it from all corners. We saw his partner to the emergency government, Benny Gantz, calling for new election in the early fall, in September. We see the right-wing parties gathering for emergency meetings to prepare for a potential hostage deal that they aren't going to accept or to agree with. We see that the protest in Israel's streets is growing larger. And we see the polls. We just had polls yesterday, two polls telling us that Netanyahu is still unpopular, that most of the public agrees that he should leave office now or right after the war, that the majority of the public believes that new election ought to take place now or after the war. So for Netanyahu, it's a matter of going from day to day, week to week, in an attempt to survive these, you know, these are treacherous waters that he's navigating. The only advantage he has is the 64-seat coalition that does not want to dismantle itself because new election might look bad for some members of this coalition. But the pressure on him to make some political changes is not going to ease. And again, a lot of it depends on the circumstances, whether there is or there isn't a hostage deal, whether there is or there isn't going into Rafah, whether there is or there isn't even something like a deal with the ultra-Orthodox parties on the draft. Even that can complicate the situation. Clearly, between now and the end of spring, the fate of this government is going to be decided.
So I thought for a moment to take the privilege of being the host and just to ask both of you for a prediction, but I'm not going to be that mean, and I'll give my own little prediction also to throw some skin in the game. But my on today, Monday, April 8th, 6:45 p.m. Israel time, my prediction will be that there's not going to be a RAF operation anytime soon. And I would also go ahead and say that I hope, and this I don't know, but I'm curious what you guys think, is if it's possible that there will be a hostage release in the coming weeks and possibly before Passover. But I, the reason that I think there's not going to be a Rafah operation anytime soon is because there's one thing in Israel that I've learned in 30 years of living here that's always stronger than anything else, and that is the desire to go back to a quiet and normal life. And it has something to do, I think, with the constant conflict and tension and hostility that we've lived with for 76 years almost as a people. And if we weren't able to always look forward and constantly were looking backwards, we wouldn't be what we are today, and we wouldn't have succeeded at anything because we'd constantly be bogged down by tragedy and mourning and grief. And that's just built in to the DNA. And Gil, as you wrote very eloquently in your Wall Street Journal piece that I saw this morning about why Israel is happy and how it's at the, you know, number five, I think, in the happiness index, is it has to do also with part of that, you know, that desire to keep going forward and living for this greater purpose. So I'm curious where you guys, the two of you, stand on a prediction. Do you think there will be Rafah? And do you think we have a chance at a hostage deal? Gil and then Shmuel.
I think it was a miracle that we got 100 hostages out. I think it was outrageous that the world didn't go ballistic on Hamas when there were 18 women who, my fear and everybody else's fear, would have looked on the camera, would have been wearing all the scars and the horrors that they endured on the camera. And so Hamas didn't release them. And that, since that moment when they didn't release those holy 18 women, I have been extremely, extremely pessimistic. It breaks my heart to say this. I've been extremely, extremely pessimistic about a hostage deal because I think Hamas is just enjoying the sadistic pain they're imposing on these human beings, on their families, and on Israel. And so I am extremely pessimistic, even though I hope every day and I pray as intensely as you do. And I it breaks my heart to give that prediction. And Rafah, I understand what you're saying, and I think there is this kind of desire also to use, as you said so intelligently, that this arc of healing, of Pesach and Passover and Memorial Day and Independence Day to kind of move on and to press a reset button. But when I look at the coalition dynamics, I think that it will be very hard for Netanyahu to hold on to Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and his internal coalition dynamics might be the thing that propel him and us into Rafah.
Shmuel?
Well, that's difficult. I think that there might be a partial hostage deal. I don't think there will be a hostage deal in which everyone comes home. If there is a hostage deal, it will be quite limited in its scope. And here I agree with Gil. I don't think Hamas has a great incentive to give hostages back at this point. From their viewpoint, their situation now is better than what it was a month or 2 months ago. So the best strategy for them is probably to wait for a bit longer in the hope that they can get even better deal in the future, at least for most of the hostages. As for Rafah, this depends on so many moving parts that I cannot give you a prediction. Israel will have to hold this threat of going into Rafah as a potential operation because the current situation is unstable. You cannot just freeze the current situation and say, okay, the war is over, we are done. You must get to a point in which Israel can tell its citizens that they can go back to Sderot and back to Kfar Aza and back to all the areas around the Gaza Strip and up north. And so assuming that the war can just end today or tomorrow with no further action, I think that's premature. Israel will have to continue in some fashion in order to at least to reshuffle the cards and make the other side understand that there needs to be a certain coming to terms that will allow Israel to send the citizens back to their homes. Otherwise, we are just losing this war, and this is not a sustainable situation for Israel.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find all our episodes where you get your podcasts. Please share widely and give us a 5-star review. We will see you back here soon.